A, national bank and investment financial institutions are in a crisis which requires a moratorium on all your non-essential commitments. And the next items here, I'm getting the information from the Portland Oregonian, September 4. The metro area population increased 680,000 by 2035. And then C, metro infrastructure improvements needed, 27 to 41 billion. Even with no growth, needs will exceed $10 billion. Borrell and conduit for the Sandy River crossing needs $21 million. The city of Gresham needs $30 million for deferred road maintenance, $285 million for infrastructure for Springwater Industrial Area, $150 million infrastructure for Pleasant Valley Area. Total is $465 million. And CG, wastewater treatment needs for Clackamas County to 2030 are $585 million to $1 billion. In my opinion, the city of Portland should put a moratorium on all future financial commitments until the cooling off period is set and met. Who knows how much the metro area citizens will lose due to the current national financial crisis. Wake up. Do not take or commit more of our limited resources at this time. Why is the Portland water biller willing to spill water from the Bull Run reservoirs for an unproved plan to help fish and then add 30% well water potentially contaminated to the Bull Run water supply at a cost of $27 million? The estimated cost of the HCP is growing larger. It increased $5 million from the draft to what you have in hand. Estimated total was 70 to 100 million. Our advice is to table this HCP until the federal government entities get the current financial crisis under control for an extended period. Please give the ratepayers and taxpayers some breathing room. Allow us to keep afloat. We need to pay our bills. Thank you for careful consideration.
Please.
I'm Jonathan Saul, Willamette Basin Conservation Director for the Nature Conservancy's Oregon Field Office. Council members and Mayor Potter, thank you for hearing testimony from the Nature Conservancy today. We're pleased to offer our strong support for the approval of the Habitat Conservation Plan developed by the City's Water Bureau from a framework that we and the larger Sandy River Basin partners helped to craft. We believe that the plan represents a fair compromise between the needs of water users, the natural resources our organization works to protect for all Oregonians, and the requirements of the Endangered Species Act and Clean Water Acts. The Conservancy has been active in the Sandy since 1969 with the vision of a watershed that provides beauty, recreation, ecological riches, and ecosystem services sustainably for our and future generations of Oregonians. For 40 years, we've worked towards that goal, acquiring land, building coalitions, working towards designation of wild and scenic river, raising awareness, and leading on-the-ground stewardship efforts. More recently, we've identified the Sandy as a priority area in our ecoregional planning processes. In fact, we consider the Sandy watershed one of our anchor sites, one in which we're willing to make significant commitments in staff time and financial resources. We currently own 5 preserves totaling almost 500 acres in the lower watershed, but have helped Metro, BLM, and other partners acquire and protect thousands of additional acres. But our work extends well beyond land acquisition. Since 2000, we've led efforts to fight invasive species and restore riparian habitat. We've worked with 500 willing landowners in the process and found widespread, consistent support for these efforts in the watershed. We're active in the Watershed Council and in the Sandy River Basin Partnership. We engaged with the Water Bureau on this plan because Not only is the Sandy important, but this is a win-win opportunity. And it's the kind of work, i.e. collaborative and science-driven, that our 23,000-member households in Oregon want us to take on and succeed with. Through the years of regular meetings, our optimism has proven justified. Our group stayed focused on science and data and worked towards a fair solution. The result is a compromise between the desires of the conservation community, honestly, and that the watershed be protected, and the reasonable expectation of the city's water bureau and the ratepayers that the burden of such restoration not fall unduly on the city. It's not a luxury plan by any means, but it is one in which the citizens of Portland and the water users of the Bull Run can legitimately claim to be practicing sustainable use of the resource. And with its emphasis on the whole watershed approach, the Habitat Conservation Plan is the right approach for the time. The opportunity to conserve the resources of this watershed are fleeting. 50 years from now, we'll look back at this as truly visionary. By taking the more holistic approach, the city is going to provide leverage to the many partners to do their work, but will also receive significant assistance from the 17 and growing partners interested and willing to help in this work.
Sir, your time is up.
I have about 5 more seconds. Okay. Thank you. The Conservancy is proud to support this hallmark of a sustainable Portland and to be part of a larger Sandy River Basin partnership as we move into implementation. I urge you to approve the HCP as proposed. Thank you.
Good morning, Mayor Potter and Commissioners. I'm Russ Plager. I work as the coordinator for the Sandy River Basin Watershed Council. The Watershed Council is a small community-based organization composed of private landowners and other key stakeholders in the Sandy Basin. And I always have to remind people that we're not a water provider. We use watershed differently in that sense. Our role really is to actively engage private landowners in habitat restoration projects to improve the health of the Sandy River Basin watershed. And during the past 8 years, we've invested as a small organization, you know, through grants that we've been able to bring in, over $830,000 in projects on private and public land. We all know that the residents and businesses of Portland derive great benefit from the Bull Run water supply. And as a result of that, we have a collective responsibility to mitigate for the impacts that Bull Run water supply operation has had on salmon, you know, as Eddie and others have already pointed out. Just for context, the Sandy River Basin is a key place for recovery of endangered salmon species in the lower Columbia region. We're one of the places where, as we work together, we could really make a difference for the fish that the people of this city and region care about. The Watershed Council's been an active participant in the process that has led to the development of this habitat conservation. And after you adopt it, we'll be one of the partners that will stand with you, along with other private and public partners, to help you implement it, make sure the work gets done, help bring in funds to do it. Some of the other significant partners are the Federal Bureau of Land Management and Western Rivers Conservancy, which is based here in Portland. Together, they've invested over $20 million in conserving key lands along the Sandy River. And just for a moment, to take off my professional hat, I've been a Portland homeowner and ratepayer for the last 25 years, and I only drink tap water. This habitat conservation plan is the right thing for our city to do. I really applaud city staff, very proactive leadership and leadership from the commissioner level, to be out in front, you know, to give you that 50-year guarantee that what you're doing is the right thing. So I applaud your leadership on this important issue. I encourage you to adopt the Habitat Conservation Plan, and I thank you for the time to testify.
Thank you, folks. Please call the next three.
Next three are Mike Myrick, John Borge, and Scott Fernandez.
You state your name when you speak. You each have 3 minutes.
Thank you. Good morning, Mayor and Council members. My name is John Borge. I'm a principal planner with Clackamas County Planning Division. And I want to thank you for the opportunity for us to share our comments in regards to the plan. I probably don't need to give you a geography lesson so that you would understand the Bull Run facility and much of that basin is located in our county. And what happens to that basin is of importance to us. And we do congratulate the city on preparing a document that has been a long time coming. Our office supports this plan for the following reasons. It recognizes and provides an example of the city's stewardship obligations towards the ecosystem of that basin. Number two, it does establish a comprehensive and responsible approach towards protection and restoration of fish populations in the entire basin. And also that's been prepared in a manner that's not one-dimensional, but does in fact represent a commitment to the long-term health of that basin. The timing really could not be better to reverse the declining populations we have in this basin, and we do want to congratulate the city on their efforts, the staff and yourselves. Is it a perfect plan? I've been involved in planning efforts for over 30 years, and it is difficult to find a method to, especially of this size and significance, to establish a plan that represents all things to all people. And so some will argue that's too narrow, the scope is too large. Others may think it's too big a burden, perhaps not large enough. Our office believes it has struck a very good balance and believes the approach to this plan, that this plan will over time provide to be an effective tool in managing the resource, both for people and for fish. I suppose it should be no surprise or offense probably should not be taken in the event there are those that might question whether or not sufficient process, outreach, meetings, discussion has occurred in preparing this thing. You know it's been a long time coming. And in my business, even my own staff will argue whether or not you've had sufficient outreach, number of meetings, hearings, etc. And in regards to what we have here, I think that the time for meetings, discussion, outreach is over. And we believe that the plan you have before you is something that's very representative of being for the good health of the basin. And we congratulate your city staff and all participants because it's a terrific illustration of how public and nonprofit organizations can join, work together, and develop a meaningful approach for all interests dedicated to saving the fish in the basin. Thank you.
My name is Scott Fernandez. As a biologist, I strongly support the Endangered Species Act and the Habitat Conservation Plans. However, the plan as it's written today, presented by the Water Bureau, does present a public health issue and a public health problem that I hope you will address before and solve before you sign on to this. And it deals with the Columbia South Shore well field. The well field is currently contaminated with radioactive materials, radon, uranium, radon, radium, and uranium also. So, and this is one of the reasons I've supported the open reservoirs is because that would allow the radon to gas to vent harmlessly. The second issue is we've recently found through other contaminants in the drinking water of estrogen, ethylene estradiol, and acetaminophen. The ethylene estradiol and the estradiol are contaminants from sewage, as it is the acetaminophen. Acetaminophen just recently last week was linked to childhood asthma. The estrogens are linked to different cancers. Additionally, we have toluene and trichloroethylene in the well field also that are also linked to cancers. These things, with the way that the plan is written, the increase in demand from the Columbia South Shore well field is producing public health issues and problems that still need to be addressed. The solution is, as I've stated in years past, to go to the Bull Run well field that has clean, pure artesian water that will not cost any, there will be no pumping costs. This water can be diverted into the dam behind the water intakes, and will be allowed, then you can blend that with the water, and then that can be supplemented into the stream, and also will allow that the drinking water to be pure without any contaminants. This would be a rotation of the water that would be used in the well field into the Bull Run well field. Additionally, this would save costs of up to $35 million, $30 million, 25 to 30 in energy costs, and would eliminate the need for the modified level intake, which presents its own problems because as the water intake goes up the water column, you're going to incur debris like algae that will increase disinfectant byproducts as it mixes with the chlorine. This is an issue that really hasn't been addressed by the Water Bureau. So I'm asking you to look at these issues from a public health standpoint, from an energy saving standpoint, and from a cost savings of almost $35 million before you sign on to this. It's a very simple solution. Thank you.
Good morning, Mayor Potter and Commissioners. My name is Mike Myrick, and I'm a member of the Association of Northwest Steelheaders, and specifically the Sandy River Chapter, and I'm an officer on both bodies. I am here today to support the HCP. I represent the steelheaders on the Sandy River Basin Partners. I've been doing so for the last 5.5 years since I retired, and I can see the benefits that the HCP will contribute to the habitat restoration and recovery of fish in the Sandy River Basin. And by the way, our chapter considers this our river. We meet on the banks of the river. We clean up the banks of the river and the river itself a minimum of 3 times a year. I'm also here to make an announcement to the council and the partners. I sit on the planning committee of the upcoming STEP conference to be held at Mount Hood Community College. STEP, for those of you who do not know, is Salmon Trout Enhancement Program, a volunteer program of the Fish and Wildlife Commission. The conference will have over 30 topics relating to fish, global warming, invasive species, and many other topics. During the evening volunteer recognition and award ceremony, the Sandy River Basin Partners will be presented a special award recognizing its endeavors over the past 10 years to achieve the results that we are here today to support. And again, I thank you, and I ask that you please give your approval of this plan. Thanks again.
Thank you, folks.
Thank you.
Is that it?
That's all who signed up.
So I'm just wondering, Eddie, do you want to respond to anything that was said?
By the comments from Mr. Fernandez?
Yeah. And Steve, I don't know if you want to come up and help or...
In terms of the concerns that were raised about groundwater and the alternative that was suggested for looking at the use of groundwater sources in the Bull Run watershed, I guess I'll make 3 quick points and we'll see if there's additional questions. First of all, the groundwater that we serve out of our groundwater system meets and exceeds all of the drinking water standards that are established under the Safe Drinking Water Act. So I'll leave it at that. Second, the HCP and the flow agreements that are contained in the HCP are not the primary drivers for future groundwater use in our system. The component of future groundwater use that's attributable to the flow agreement in the HCP is about 20 to 25% of our future groundwater use. So the issue of groundwater usage is really independent of what we do in terms of providing the flows. We need to provide the flows to help fish. Whether we use groundwater or not to backfill that is a decision for us to make as a city and as a community. We did look at the suggestion through the federal EIS process of using Bull Run groundwater in a way that was suggested by the Portland Utility Review Board. And one of the principal problems with that approach is that the water temperature of the Bull Run groundwater isn't adequately cold enough for us to cool the temperatures as we need to do and as we plan to do with using the multi-level intake structure that we talked about. So I guess I'll leave those comments with you, and if there's further questions, we'd be happy to talk about them.
Well, specific to the field wells, he Scott mentioned a number of particular contaminants, uranium, radon, estrogen, and several others. Are those actually in the groundwater, and is that different from what we find in the Bull Run reservoir water?
The Bull Run or the groundwater is a completely different source, and so the constituency, the water chemistry of the groundwater is completely different from the Bull Run. What we found most recently was the presence of some of these microcontaminants that Scott referenced, including essentially, traces of Tylenol, caffeine, these types of substances, and that's something that's been happening throughout the nation in all kinds of sources. The Bull Run itself actually had a detection of caffeine at these very micro contaminant levels that are parts per trillion. So it's something on the order of a grain of sand in a swimming pool. So this is a new and emerging issue that the drinking water industry is confronting, basically, which is it's a manifestation of the advances in our monitoring capability. And what it is that we can detect right now far outstrips our ability to even understand what it means. And so that's something that we're grappling with as an entire industry throughout the country to try to figure out what is significant. Is there something significant about these amounts? And at the same time, we're working with drug companies to look at take-back programs and other things to see if we can reduce even those trace amounts that we're finding.
So then, I guess Scott's point is if we are going to be using the field wells more, then the chances of folks who drink our water ingesting those contaminants would increase.
Yes, if we need to use additional groundwater going forward. The estimates that are in our HCP include assumptions on how many customers we're going to serve in the future, including our current wholesale customer base. We need it in order to come up with a plan to take a very conservative estimate of how much water we need to be serving in our drinking water system going forward. So there is a chance that we will actually serve fewer people in the future, depending on the decisions of some of our wholesale customers. So if we do find issues with groundwater, yes, and if we do need to serve the same amount of people or more into the future, we will be using groundwater more. One of the most important factors about our groundwater system, though, is that it is because of our groundwater system that we're actually able to maintain our unfiltered status in the Bull Run. We occasionally need to use our groundwater system as a 100% source when we have storms that affect our ability to use the Bull Run in the wintertime. And so that's always going to be a situation for us as long as we continue to remain an unfiltered drinking water system.
So one of the things Scott said was there was radium and uranium found in the well fields. Has there been any of those products found in testing of the water?
I'm not aware of.
I think we need to make that really clear because one could be misled to think by the artful use of the words that he was suggesting that the water was contaminated with those, and they're not. And our testing does not indicate that.
Other questions from commissioners? Scott, I'm going to allow you to talk a second time, but please keep your remarks brief.
Thank you. radon is a decay product of uranium, and these are sequential. Radon cannot appear without uranium being present. The same thing with radium. It decays to radon. Those two, radium and uranium have not been tested for, but they are the only source of radon. So it is geologically complete to understand that that's the sequence of events. The second thing I want to say is that you have just been given documents that show the green dot that you see there is the temperature that the well water from the Bull Run well field came out as. And that is within the zone of being okay with the Clean Water Act. And also the goal, according to the Water Bureau, for that temperature of that stream is below 21 degrees during the summer. So you can see that there are increases in temperature.
I think you're getting a little feel from what we've been talking about. Are you suggesting or do you have information that there is radon or uranium in the well fields?
Radon has been shown through the water sampling of the Water Bureau that radon is present through their
In the well field.
In the well
field. Not in the water.
Well, the water was tested for radon by your bureau or whomever the lab was, and according to your water quality reports, radon is present. Radon is a gas.
I thought you just said it wasn't tested for.
I said radium wasn't tested for. There are three components. Uranium decays to radium, which decays to radon. Radon is the final sequence in the event.
So, Eddie?
What we do know about radon in the groundwater is that, first of all, EPA is in the process of developing a drinking water regulation specifically to address radon. And there have been some discussions about what the proposed contaminant level will be for radon in drinking water. And we have not found amounts of radon in our drinking water that would exceed at least that preliminary standard. So we'll know more once there is a final rule whether or not there's any issues there. Radon is a naturally occurring gas that shows up throughout the Portland area. There was a school a few years ago, a Portland public school, that actually had to close based on off-gassing of radon in the basement of that facility. So it is present in the area, and it is something that we will continue to monitor. One thing we're in complete agreement with Mr. Fernandez is we don't want to be serving drinking water that's a public health risk. And so anything that we find, any evidence that we find that suggests that we need to address these matters, we'll be taking that very seriously.
But as I understand, what you're saying is, notwithstanding that may be an issue, it isn't any more of an issue with this HCP plant, that the projections are that the amount of well water that's used currently will be the amount that's used in the future.
What I'm saying is that any additional usage of groundwater going forward is much more attributable to additional population growth that we would be serving than it has to do with this HCP. The HCP and the flow commitments that we've made in it only constitute 20 to 25% of the future groundwater needs. And as I said before, as long as we continue to remain an unfiltered drinking water system, we're going to need a full backup that we can turn to use when we can't use the bull run.
Which we do often throughout the year now. I mean, we turn on groundwater.
We've probably done it over 10 times since we've had groundwater.
So is radon, which is a byproduct of those two, uranium and radium, can radon be removed from water? Your David, director is saying yes. Dave, you want to comment on that?
Go ahead.
Just take care.
All right. I'm David Schaff. I'm the director of the Water Bureau, and as you know, I'm not an engineer, but Scott is correct in that you can strip radon through off-gassing, and if the federal government does implement a radon rule that we have to deal with, it's a fairly simple engineering solution. So it is not something that we're anticipating being a problem at all.
You're saying it's much less than some of the other prescriptions that the EPA has been discussing?
It may or may not require us to do anything. If our detections of radon are below the minimum or maximum contaminant level that they establish, we may not have to do anything. If we do, as I said, it's a fairly simple engineering solution. Scott mentioned that the open reservoirs are a place where they can off gas. It's also possible to do it through our Powell Butte Reservoir and any of our other facilities. So it's not a hard engineering solution to deal with the radon.
Scott, we're going to have to.
Okay, but that's just an incorrect statement from an engineering standpoint. Radon is a nuclear thing. If it's going to go, the engineering that he's talking about, it's going to go through water. If water goes through something, it's the nuclear stuff is going to go through water also. So it's not the simplest way is to vent it through the air. That's it. It's that simple.
That's correct. That is correct. And that's what we would do.
Thank you. Was that all the folks who signed up to testify?
That was all who signed up.
Is there anyone here who wishes to testify this specific issue? It's a non-emergency and moves to a second reading.
I want to thank everybody that's here today for all of the work that's gone into this. This is truly a document to be proud of, and one always hesitates to start naming people to thank because then you leave out people. But I would be remiss if I didn't mention, Michael Hamm, thank you for your work and all of the expertise you brought to the table. And, of course, Gary Larson, again, who is an outstanding partner with us on this and many, many other issues. Eddie Campbell and his entire team. I think it's important to acknowledge the important endorsement by Nature Conservancy, a group I hold in high regard. The steelheaders that we heard from are really not just a sportsman, but true environmentalists. I've worked with them for years, including in the legislature. They're outstanding stewards, Clackamas County, and others. And I would just, while all of you are here, just say that we, those of us from European ancestry inherited some good traits. We also inherited some not-so-good traits. We have this propensity to consume without thinking about the two or three steps that happen after the consumption in terms of impact on the environment. We're just now becoming aware of the impact of unmitigated burning of fossil fuels in terms of the CO2 impact on the Earth's atmosphere and the global warming that's causing that. This, in a much smaller scale, is us learning really not so much from ourselves, but actually going back to Native Americans. And Native Americans were the ultimate conservationists. They would do nothing to despoil the environment, not just for their generation, but for future generations. That's a lesson we are learning hard. This is an example of us learning that lesson. There is no reason we can't coexist on this earth with other species that can't speak for themselves and do what we need to do to survive, but do it in a way that's smarter than what we've done in the last 200 or 300 years in this country, and do it in a way that allows our fisheries to thrive and prosper, that do it in a way that allows our forests to thrive and prosper and find the balance that I think this is an example of finding. And so I want the staff to know how much I appreciate your excellent work on this, and it's something I'm very, very proud of. Thank you.
I'm going to move to the regular agenda. I'd like to have item 1330 heard first. It's emergency ordinance. I have to leave at 11:30, so okay. I'd like to have the emergency. Is that okay, folks? Yeah. Please read item 1330.
Authorize a sole source contract between the Neighborhood Parks Council and Portland Park and Recreation for the development and implementation of Park Scan.
Mr. Salzman.
Thank you, Mayor. Council previously approved acceptance of a $135,000 grant from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation for the development of Park Scan, a web-based reporting system that will track the resolution of issues that our park users encounter in our parks. The Park Scan website will give community users a tool that they can report any maintenance issues they observe, and it also gives us any maintenance, security, or anything else. It also gives us a way to respond to them through the web as well. As part of our grant, receiving the grant from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, we committed to hire the group, the Neighborhood Parks Council, the nonprofit that pioneered Park Scan, to develop the system for us. The contract amount is $215,000 altogether. $135,000 of that is funded by the foundation. So parks will pay no more than $25,000 per year for 3 years of ongoing maintenance and support. Ali Ryan is here to answer any questions if you have them. Otherwise, I would urge council support.
Questions? Do we have anyone signed up to testify?
I did not have a sign-up sheet for this.
Is there anyone here who wishes to testify to this specific issue? It's emergency. Please call the vote.
Fish?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye. Turn to the front of our regular agenda. Please read item 1324.
adopt City 2008-2012 Equal Employment Opportunity Affirmative Action Plan.
Good morning, Mayor, Commissioners. My name is Joseph Quinones. I'm with the Bureau of Human Resources Office of Diversity Development and Affirmative Action, and I'm here today to present to you your City Affirmative Action Plan for the years 2008-2012. You received an executive summary of this already. What you haven't received is the entire plan. It looks like this in draft form and is available online at our website. And I'm here to talk about the highlights of the plan and talk about some of the numbers in the plan. I really want to do a couple of things today. I want to, first of all, summarize for you the accomplishments of the 2005-2008 plan, which is what we are just coming to the end of. And there's some specific things that will help you in understanding the new plan by understanding how we functioned in the last plan that we had. The second thing I want to do is highlight some of the components of the new plan, the 2008-2012 plan, and then I want to tie the plan to the overall city's diversity development strategic initiative. So the document you've just been handed is really a statistical summary, a data comparison of the 2005-2008 plan from the beginning data to the ending data of that plan. Essentially, when we went into the 2005-2008 plan, the city was at a rate of 14.62% minority employees and 31.95% female employees. In the 3 years the plan was in operation, we moved to a 16.5% minority employment and a 34% female employment in the city employees. So essentially, over the 3 years, we have really increased our employment of both females and minorities. Significantly, we've actually had a total of, in numbers, 285 new employees added to the city roll since 2005. Of that number, 141 are minorities. So we've had a 50% higher rate in the last 3 years of minorities. That's really significant. The overall numbers, you know, sort of pale in comparison to that notion that we've actually really concentrated our efforts and really done very well in hiring over the last 3 years. We ended that last plan with some percentages that if you see on page 2 of the little handout you just received, the total employees increased by 5%. African American or black employees had no increase whatsoever, and I'll explain that in a moment because I think there's some issues there. Asian employees increased by 27%. Hispanic employees increased by 0.12%. Native American employees increased by 0.22%. And overall, minority employees increased by 1.84%.
I want to make sure I'm hearing these numbers right. When you say 0.22%, are you meaning 1/5 of 1%?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. The numbers themselves, well, those percentages are affected by one other factor, which is that the new way of reporting EEO categories changed in the middle of this affirmative action plan. So when we started the plan, Asians and Pacific Islanders were combined. At the end of the plan, they were separated out, so our data was separated out as well. So now we have a Pacific Islander category all of its own, which includes 4 employees from the city. Also, at the same time, a new category was added, which was 2 or more minorities. So you come from 2 or more racial distinct backgrounds. And we have 65 people who chose that as their category who work for the city now. So in those cases, it may be someone who is black ancestry and white ancestry, native ancestry and black ancestry, Asian ancestry and Hispanic ancestry. We just don't know what those are because those numbers are not broken out any further. But going forward, the categories we'll be monitoring are black, Asian, Pacific Islander, Hispanic, Native, and 2 or more. But overall, we still have had an increase of 141 of all of the minorities working for the city in the last 3 years.
In the context of how many employees?
We have 5,627 employees as of the time of this report. Of that number, our total minorities are 962 out of the 5,000, or 16.46%.
And what was the increase?
The increase was, let's see. The increase for minorities overall was 1.84%, almost 2%.
And what is the, and demographically in the city of Portland, the percentage of people of color?
We actually, the data for the demographics coming out of the Census Bureau really speaks to what is a catchment area for the whole region, which goes down to Albany. So the census data from the U.S. Census data doesn't just collect the city of Portland. It collects
Portland
all
state doesn't break that up?
I haven't seen any figures from the state that breaks it out.
I saw a figure of approximately 20%. That's minority for this city.
Excuse me, Mayor. Yes, that's right, and that's what you set as a target for us when we went into the 2005, 2008 plan. And so, based on that,
we're at 19.
I'm sorry.
At 19, did you say?
At 20%.
What are we at?
We're at 16.46%. Okay.
And I'm trying to figure out what then the marginal increase was.
2%.
2%. So 2%. We've increased. We were at like 14 and a
half.
We
were 14 and a half, and now we're 15 or 16 and a half.
16 and a half.
Okay. So, and what my, I think that this, okay. I think that this new plan, this 2008-2012 plan, may well carry us into that 20% over the next 4 years. If we've seen, because we're really looking at a 3.5% increase to achieve the 20% over the next 4 years.
And in a very concise way, give me the elements that are new in this plan you're adopting that you think will achieve results, which we have.
Certainly. One of them actually comes out of an impetus you gave to the Bureau of Human Resources, in that we have created and will be implementing what we're calling a diversity-focused recruitment initiative, which will be something involving the entire city, all the bureaus, and, of course, the Bureau of Human Resources. That's coming to your desk when Yvonne returns and approves that on the 29th. It'll go to her, and she'll bring it to you.
What does that mean?
It means a couple of things. There are really sorry I didn't bring that particular plan with me, but I can remember most of it.
I mean, does it mean one of the things I've argued for my own bureaus to do is not overcomplicate this approach, take a table, open it up down at Smith Center at Portland State, and set some city employees down.
Yeah.
Does it include elements like that?
It does.
Okay.
It does. And in fact, let me speak to that plan in the context of the overall city then and do it. The bureaus have really initiated a number and have established in the new plan a number of specific activities. One is, as you suggest, to continue to work in job fairs that are sponsored by other organizations, minority organizations in town here, including ETAPS, including the Women in Trades, including SEI, including the Open Metal School, for instance. All of those groups and other groups representing minority organizations or minority communities here in Portland have job fairs of one kind or another, or at least career day opportunities. So not only will the Bureau of Human Resources participate in those, but so will other bureaus. Other bureaus will as well, and they've set that target within their part of the plan.
So if we were, for instance, I had a meeting. I don't know if Anna was there or not, but Yvonne was with ETAP.
I was there, sir.
DeBoer, and you were there.
Okay. Yes.
And DeBoer, so we talked about a specific strategy to work with, and it stands for training and apprenticeship. What's the E? Employee training?
Evening
training and apprenticeship program.
Yes.
So I've gone to it. I've watched it. I participated in the graduation ceremony. It is an absolutely outstanding program.
Yes,
run by Deborah Williams. Is it?
Yes.
Deborah Williams. So she actually had a plan, and we were working with her to transfer people that graduate from that program to city employment in something like the apprenticeship program. And I never followed up to see what happened as a result of that.
And that's what we're preparing for you, what we prepared for you, which, again, Yvonne has to review upon her return.
Okay.
And then they'll come to your desk.
So that's part of that.
It is absolutely part of it,
that's,
yes.
That's good news.
Yes. There are We have also, bureaus have also established partnerships with high schools and other and institutions of higher learning, which including the Hatfield School of Government, and all of the minority student organizations in regionally and statewide that we have communication with them. We also have bureaus that have established relationships with the minority professional organizations, engineers, planners, those kinds of organizations, that we are continuing to refer to, which is to say we've had relationships with them in the past. We've let those relationships lapse, or we just haven't used them as effectively. But now we have a program in place and a staff, actually my office, who is dedicated to making sure that those relationships remain effective, remain working, remain alive. And so when we present the plan to you, you'll see that it includes that whenever a new announcement, job announcement is made where there's a job opening here, we're going to go and look at, one, what is the statistical analysis of that? Are we underutilized or not relative to our people who are available and whether they're male or female or minority or female? And if we are, then that sets very specific actions in motion where we start to contact these various agencies and groups. And our targeted media outreach using the minority media outlets, both print and electronic media, and also using websites and some of the social networking groups that we've become aware of and that we're using in that way. So it's really a very comprehensive approach. And it's not just out of my office. It's not just out of VHR or my office. It's all the bureaus are, to some degree, one degree or another, engaged in those kinds of activities, and that's what's listed.
And I'm sorry to consume so much time on this, but it's an area I've spent a lot of time
with, sir,
in my own bureaus and VHR. And I appreciate what you're saying, but what I have learned is that despite all of our best intentions, we sometimes end up being confounded by our own rules, as we discovered when we were discussing the program with Deborah Williams. And I fear we sometimes begin enforcing our rules for the rule's sake and don't recognize that they're standing in the way of us getting otherwise well-qualified people but using processes that maybe don't necessarily conform with our current rules. And to be as blunt as I possibly can, I think as opposed to not hiring people because of our rules, we ought to change our rules and amend our rules to make them more flexible to allow us to take candidates from programs like ETAP and others so that we don't have these barriers that exist artificially, I will call them, because of rules we've adopted.
Thank you, sir.
Commissioners, Mayor Potter, if I may, Anna Kenwood, Assistant Human Resources Director. One of the things I did want to respond to, Commissioner Leonard, is we are actually in the process of revamping all of our rules and processes around the way we're conducting recruitments.
Nice.
We were given the opportunity to do that in part because of the charter reform that was passed the beginning of last year. So we are in the process of doing that, recognizing that some of the things are, well, close to ancient have not kept up with some of the changes. And now with the charter reform, we're allowed to make some sweeping changes. So we're definitely looking at that and what stands in the way of those kinds of recruitments.
Nice.
And, of course, still maintaining the merit-based system. But we have certain processes that we know can get in the way. So.
Yes.
And I have a question for you. First of all, I want to apologize. I was thinking earlier, you know, you and I both grew up basically in the same county and the East Coast. We know each other when I was practicing law, but you're now actually doing HR for the Fire Bureau, and I confused you with someone who was doing
She's doing HR for the whole city.
Yeah, yeah, but that's how I deal with it.
Oh, okay.
It's HR through the Fire Bureau, and yeah. I'm still thinking you're wearing the hat as a lawyer, and so I apologize.
Oh, she is, trust me.
Excuse me, Commissioner. No, I have my license. I don't practice law for the city.
Yeah, well, okay.
I remember doing battle with her when she was doing it full time, so I have
so
a lot of
I,
respect
actually.
For Anna. I'm just curious, when I look at these charts, I see gender, race, and national origin reflected. Why not sexual minorities?
Joseph, you want to respond to that?
The Affirmative Action Plan is in response to a mandate from the federal government. We have to provide a plan. The federal government does not recognize sexual minorities.
That doesn't mean we can't address it.
That's why we can't address it in this particular plan.
That doesn't mean we can't address it.
That's true.
Yeah.
I understand your point. It may not, and it may or may not apply to a percentage goal that we've set, but it could cause us to amend that goal to reflect. But I think the point you've made that the federal government requirements don't require us to do as part of this, I just think that since the city clearly understands that sexual minorities are part of its overall affirmative action plan, I wouldn't want their omission from this chart to reflect some backing off of our commitment to making this a hospitable place also for the sexual minority community.
You know, the sexual minorities community is a self-identification process. Some folks do not wish to be identified. So it does present a problem in terms of trying to keep an accurate number. But I agree with your basic premise that it should be one of those things that we emphasize, but also the question about people with disabilities.
Yes, sir.
That's not on here either.
It actually is, and it's not. We have not been keeping that data, but part of the new plan is we'll begin keeping data on people with disabilities and also on veterans. And those are new requirements that come out of the federal government this last year, and we're going to move into a situation being able to comply with that requirement. As you say, all of these categories are actually self-identification and voluntary. I can say I'm whatever race I want to or whatever gender I want to or whether or not I'm a person with a disability. Totally, we don't ask people to prove it, basically, except in the case of disability where we might be required to make an accommodation. We might ask for some issues, some information around that. But the only people who make a decision about whether or not you are a particular race or not is yourself. So all our employees voluntarily go in and take a look at this. I think you're right that we ought to take a look at how we're going to set some kind of goals and start tracking that for those people who voluntarily want to let us know that whatever their sexual orientation is. We would not include it in this plan, but there must be some mechanism that we would be able to include in because the feds will simply not even acknowledge that or even have it. They don't want it.
At least with this administration.
Exactly.
Well, I would urge us to just include a column so we can track stuff, even if it doesn't pertain to our federal reporting. But I want to go back, Joseph, to something you discussed with Commissioner Leonard earlier.
Yes, sir.
I know that the minority chambers and the Minority Newspaper Association have pretty good outlets and have way. At the Housing Bureau, of course, we work with the chambers to do housing fairs and make sure that we take advantage of their networks.
Yes, sir.
Are we making the same investment in terms of outreach to those entities, minority chambers and newspapers? Are we doing the same or enhanced posting of notices in the newspapers, both electronically and in print?
Yes, we are. And one thing in response again to Commissioner Leonard, we have some very specific plans relative to outreach for very specific job classifications. For instance, ETAP really works on trades, the building trades in particular. And one of the things, one component of our plan is that we will be going directly to organizations like ETAP and SEI, Women in Trades, and so forth, and using them as an outlet for announcing our positions. At the same time, they will be posted, as they usually are, online, on Portland Online, so people can come in and take a look at them. But in those instances where we're really looking to enhance our diversity in the trades, we probably won't be making those announcements in, like, the Oregonian, for instance, because we have enough already applications coming through our online process of the dominant culture and minority or majority culture folks that really when we do outreach to Open Meadow, to Women in Trades, to SEI, to ETAP.
Which by the way, is are diverse organizations. One should not assume that they're all exclusively people of color that go through
not.
Programs.
Right.
They have a wide variety of people with a wide variety of backgrounds.
Typically, they are going to be people from lower economic status and at risk, particularly for ETAPs and Open Meadow.
So one other question. Commissioner Adams sits on the board of Work Systems, Inc.
Yes.
At the Bureau of Housing and Community Development, we have an economic opportunity initiative. In fact, we give money to support ETAP, and we have some programs. So we have a lot of experience at the Bureau.
Yes, sir.
Dealing through our anti-poverty programs with some of the issues you're dealing with. Are the folks at BHCD working with you on outreach issues?
Not general outreach issues like for the whole city, but specific to the bureaus, yes. To the Bureau, yes.
I think, I mean, maybe you're already doing it, but I think bringing Work Systems and economic opportunity in, you have some good networks that they've established and there might be some interesting ideas about how we do better outreach.
We actually have worked with them in the past, particularly with regard to our summer youth employment program. And at one point we had a specific program with Work Systems to employ students of theirs. Unfortunately, our summer youth employment program is just summer based, and they're looking for year round kind of employment. We really couldn't, but we had students, if you will, excuse me, participate in the summer program, then transfer over to work systems.
One other thing, Joseph, I went to Northeastern Law School, which has a co-op program, and I remember an employer once telling me that they didn't think Northeastern Law School was a particularly high prestige law school.
Okay.
But the benefit of the co-op program was it put students in workplaces where they got to show their stuff, and that that actually became an advantage over people that had better credentials but were coming in off of a resume. So I became a real convert to this idea of co-op education. And I, at some point, I'd love to know more about our comprehensive plan around internships and co-ops and other things, because sometimes the best path to employment, as we know, is to have someone come in, work in a short-term employment, get that experience and maybe a champion.
Yes, sir.
And then have that lead to full-time employment. And I know at Northeastern it was a huge equalizer in getting students from non-traditional backgrounds into places that they otherwise wouldn't be welcome.
Absolutely, Commissioner. We actually, there have been students from the Summer Youth Employment Program who have obtained city jobs. We've had one who actually has come back and worked for us as a temporary employee. So, yeah, that's a great avenue in. And I think in response to the question about sort of the outreach issues, part of what Joseph's office is looking at in coordination with, you know, our employment and development is smarter use of our advertising dollars and a different outreach approach. It's one of the things when Yvonne and I have met with bureaus, when we meet with them each year, one of the things the bureaus have consistently asked for is more assistance in how to do the outreach recruitment. And we've been looking at that. One of the things we realize is we've not done thorough evaluation in terms of when we advertise the applicants we're getting from those advertisements. We do it with the job fair, and it's really interesting to see, you know, what people are looking at in terms of coming in, because part of it is, you know, where you basically get the most bang. And as Joseph said, sometimes it's going to be more focused on electronic advertising. Sometimes it may be something else. It may be the radio. There's a lot of different ways in addition to simply Portland Online and the Oregonian that I think will be very, very effective in continuing our outreach efforts. And that's one of the things that Joseph's office is working on. So,
yeah, if I may add, another component of the program that we're talking about, Commissioner, is that we also have to start to bring our city managers and administrators, bureau administrators, into connection, into relationship with organizations out, both local and regional. And so one of the aspects of this outreach program is we get people who are managers and administrators of city bureaus to go out and go to events, which I'm sure all of you have attended, like Say Hey events, Breakfast of Champions of Diversity events, and actually going and meeting with the people at the NAACP, at PECUN, the various organizations that really represent people seeking employment from minority communities, and have them build relationships and build liaisons with those groups. One of the most effective managers that I knew when I worked for the state had a Rolodex sitting on his desk, and anytime a job opened up, he was a person of European descent, anytime a job opened up, he would flip that Rolodex open and he'd start calling names of people he knew and had a personal relationship with and inviting them to send someone to come and apply for this job. And he knew where to go. And that kind of personal contact was invaluable to him. He invariably overshot the goals that he had for recruitment and hiring because of that personal contact and those personal relationships. We want to help managers in the city develop those, and then we'll provide the technical support for them to advance their outreach goals.
I think that's
you
great.
You know, I think what you folks, this is really good. One of the things, though, is after we hire them is to retain them.
Yes, sir.
And I really appreciate the fact that a group of minority employees, sexual orientation, people with disabilities, formed DEEP.
Yes, sir.
And I think DEEP has had a tremendous impact on the organization in terms of providing support to the different groups within our city. And I really appreciate what they do often. I feel like they're underrecognized because they do a lot more work than perhaps what we recognize. So I have to pardon myself. I have to go to another meeting. So turn it over to the president of the council.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
I wanted to make one observation that I've become concerned recently on the subject of current employees who are minority employees. Some of them approach me to express to me their